Welcome to today's edition of The Warrior Poet. Today we're going to talk about Charlie Munger and hunger for Munger, as well as what you might do with your life. Several of you out there might be hungry for something more in your life. It's a common complaint of probably most adults, at least at some point in their life, if not throughout their entire lives. We've all heard those around us, as well as ourselves, doing some soul searching about what we're up to in life. Maybe that's because you've got a mission orientation, like a lot of members of our audience. Or maybe it's just because you've reached a plateau. Or in the words of one of my Harvard Business School classmates in a recent virtual COVID-friendly reunion, in a world where there's competition for scarce resources, then you need to optimize, right? So for some reason this morning, I woke up with a desire to read some Charlie Munger. And I talked before about the worthless chorus, the wisdom that's all around us that we ignore in a previous episode of that name, Worthless Chorus. I would say that the contrarian in me, for some reason, never wanted to go to a Berkshire Hathaway shareholder meeting or read their annual reports. Some people read that stuff voraciously over and over to try and internalize more and more wisdom there. And I'm not denying that we should learn from those who have been successful by any means. And I'm not denying also that there's plenty of wisdom in there about life beyond business, as well as probably plenty of pearls of wisdom from Messrs. Warren and Buffett and Charlie Munger about society and just the growth of civilization and a lot of moral components as well. But for whatever reason, maybe it's just because everyone else seemed to adore them, that I look elsewhere for my learning. But I ran across, as I was searching around, a great speech that's wonderfully transcribed, thankfully, by perhaps the people at Farnham Street. It's a blog. If you haven't checked it out, it's a really great blog. It talks a lot about learning and psychology, meta-learning, philosophy, all generally directed towards business outcomes, but not exclusively by any means. And you can benefit even if you're an artist or in a nonprofit. I highly recommend it. Farnham Street. Anyway, there's this entry called The Psychology of Human Misjudgment. And I'll include a link to the actual YouTube so you can just listen to it maybe at 2x speed because it's kind of slow. There are lots of great nuggets in here. I won't read to you all the 24 standard causes of human misjudgment, nor the questions that follow that. Interestingly, though, number one, I've now got this hunger for more of Charlie Munger's material just after this one exposure to it. I had heard plenty of his words of wisdom and sound bites and short quotes before, and I always found them fine. But after reading this full post slash lecture I think he gave at Harvard a while back, I am hooked. Secondly, Charlie Munger in here relates a story where he had, I guess at a dinner party, each person there drew somebody else as their dinner partner and got to know them for the duration of that dinner. And he drew what he described as a very beautiful young lady. Turned out she was married to some other very famous, successful person there at the event. As soon as they sat down, she asked them, "Mr. Munger, could you describe in one word what you can attribute all your wonderful success to?" Charlie Munger says that immediately he realized he was being manipulated, but thoroughly enjoyed it nonetheless. And that to this day, he can't meet this woman without kind of smiling and being happy, even though he was manipulated from the start because she was appealing to his vanity and just patronizing him, obviously. There are oftentimes, we've talked about before in The Warrior Poet, where the mind is such where sometimes tricks for ourselves work, even though we know they're a trick. That is to say, other people can play tricks on us. We know they're playing a trick, and either we enjoy it and are glad, or we resent it, but we go along with the trick anyway because of our psychological failings. Of course, we can turn this on ourselves, though, and we can be kind of another third party, if you will, against ourselves to try and get ourselves to do what we think we should do, even all the while being in on the conspiracy. I think Charlie Munger probably got carried away with himself in terms of how many psychological failings we all have. He enumerated 24. He admits that these are not all mutually exclusive. In reality, I think he could probably have simplified it down to maybe somewhere between 6 and 10 failings. That being said, whatever works for you, right? Whether it's Ray Dalio coming up with principles for himself, or as I've talked about, coming up with my own principles, what matters is the granularity, the specificity, the degree to which that principle resonates with you. And if having 24 of the same thing gives you different flavors and tips and tricks and infrastructure in your life, then so be it. So not that you need my permission, Charlie Munger, but you do you. How can we use that knowledge of our own psychology, though, to our benefit? Talking about being in on the conspiracy against ourselves leads me to some questions about what all of us should do in our lives. I occasionally have people approach me asking about going to business school or becoming a SEAL or entering the corporate sector or just general advice as a friend or someone they've been introduced to, being me, about what they should do with their lives. And quite frankly, so all of us encounter this problem, so I'm not above it either in terms of what that mission ultimately should be and what we're working back from. Those who know their mission in life from day one and stick with it until they die are few and far between. But as we've pointed out here before, if the mind is flexible and if you can grow, and if what you do is sometimes not fun at first, but you gain an appreciation for it, whether that be piano lessons or soccer or writing essays and a book. It might not be fun at first, but then you learn the craft and you learn to love the craft. It's human nature. And we mentioned several books here before, like Cal Newport's book, among others, Robert Greene's Mastery, that go into this in a lot of detail and back it with a lot of science. That sometimes we just grow to appreciate and love things that weren't clear from the start. But as our mind evolves, then how do we tackle that question of what we should do in life? Does that mean we should just do anything? Does that mean we should pick the hardest thing there is to learn because maybe that'll bring us the biggest rewards once we get through years and years and years of pain to learn that thing and appreciate it? Sometimes people recommend just choosing the thing that gives you the most options. Derek Sivers, who we've mentioned here before, is one of those people who he likes to optimize for the most options in the future. That can be a good decision criterion, but it can't be the only one. And in many ways, choosing the thing that gives you the most options, while does ensure that you're not hemmed in, and might help you prevent a bad choice, it also doesn't necessarily lead you to an optimum. And it likely punts a lot of the hard questions down the road forever. You're constantly choosing more options, but you've never just chosen one thing at that point. I came across this blog called Ayo the Author, A-Y-O, and he's got some books on Amazon. His article, How to Decide What to Do with Your Life, ranks very highly on Google for such questions. It might be tempting to go to Quora for something like this, but I found Quora to be really terrible for philosophical questions and life questions. I've found it to just be helpful for technical topics, to be honest. And really, the audience of Quora is primarily technical people, I think. When it comes to the more philosophical, those who tend to be extremely data and science oriented may fail at answering things that are more open-ended. Ayo, the author, his article, I actually thought it was going to be terrible just by the title. It looked like it was just optimized in terms of a clickbait title and everything else. But his blog is actually very well thought out. I'll have a link in the show notes. He gives some good tips for figuring this out. And I think he acknowledges a lot of the faults of trying to come up with an answer. He suggests things like personality tests and career tests. Those are extremely popular now. Again, I'm a contrarian, so I don't jump into those things all the time. I have a vague notion of what my four letters are in the Myers-Briggs, but I can never get it exactly right compared to the couple times that I've taken it in my life years ago. I think the issue with that approach is that those are designed by people who are flawed like you, and they don't really give you one answer. And if they do give you one answer of what your career should be, well, that's just dumb, right? There are an infinite number of options. And yes, are we very much alike other humans? Sure. But in many ways, you are an incredibly complex individual. And to say that a short test can know you and match you against an infinite number of options is really foolhardy. The fact is, there's no closed form solution, as we used to say on the trading desk. It's a mathematical term. Some people might use the word convex, where there's a clear method that you can use to solve a problem. That's what you would call a closed form solution. And there's only one answer that you can get. Of course, that's not life. We all realize that. Life is far too random. There are too many variables, too many things that can happen that are out of your control. Market forces, forces of nature, society, the economy. But then again, there are some grains of intense truth that you can learn about yourself through such tests. Mr. Ayo here does make the point. This is actually the first thing he says in the article. Be grateful you have the option in the first place. And also, stop doing this to yourself. At first, when I saw the heading, I wasn't clear what this was. But then it becomes abundantly clear that constantly asking yourself what you should do in your life, he says, it drops cortisol hand grenades throughout your body when you think about them for too long. This is what he calls the double-edged sword of self-help. You can know a lot of cool shit, in the words of The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, I think that was, but not actually apply it. Now, the formula he lists out does have things like personality tests, your strengths, obviously. He has in there not overthinking the process. Of course, he tries to sell some of his books, so that's cool. I think the actually best answer he has amidst this list of answers, and it's not a really long post, which I actually like. It's kind of very simple advice, concisely given. His best advice in that whole section is think about when you're 14 years old, which plenty of other people talk about this, right? What did you enjoy when you're in kindergarten? What did you enjoy before, you know, the world ruined your curiosity and passion? So that's not necessarily novel at all. People have been probably saying that for a century or millennia, who knows? But he does say that you should ask yourself, it would be cool. I guess that's not asking yourself. But if you use the phrase, wouldn't it be cool if, and then follow that with whatever you think would be cool in your life. I would say that in some ways, that is the question that I asked myself and then answered with becoming a Navy SEAL. That would be cool. And it was cool. It was hard, but it was cool. Now, that route is an easily identifiable goal with a pretty defined path. Not pretty defined. It's very defined. The fact that most people, the overwhelming majority of people, cannot follow that path and don't follow that path doesn't negate the fact that the path is very easy to follow. There are plenty of resources out there about preparing to become a SEAL or enter training, rather, and then plenty of resources that describe what training's like. I mean, the Discovery Channel made a documentary about it in which some of my Naval Academy classmates actually appear, which is very well done, by the way. If any of you are younger and aspiring SEALs, I highly recommend watching that. Finally, Mr. Io talks about escaping society's box, you know, kind of exiting the matrix, talking about how, hey, you'll never actually figure out the answer to this question. And then finally, find what you love and let it kill you. And this is less about finding that purpose as opposed to sort of settling on something that you really enjoy and just really digging in. And then, in his words, italicized, he says, if you're open to the pain and finding something you love, well, that's what love is. And there you have it, a simple episode for a pretty simple topic. There's plenty of self-help resources out there. Whether you check out IO, whether you internalize the stuff I've got here, maybe it's just time to read something a little better, whether that be Charlie Munger or something at that higher level of understanding yourself. And then maybe just take a break. Go on a self-help hunger strike, if you will. Okay, now's that time of the program where we get all the way wet.
That we want our national policy based on what we know in our hearts is morally right. We cannot buy our security, our freedom from the threat of the bomb, by committing an immorality so great as saying to a billion human beings now enslaved behind the Iron Curtain, give up your dreams of freedom, because to save our own skins, we're willing to make a deal with your slave masters. Alexander Hamilton said, a nation which can prefer disgrace to danger is prepared for a master and deserves one.
Now, this is not a political show. We've said that several times before. I used to be a political junkie. I have written political pieces, but I've since become clean, if you will, and much more sober about where I stand politically. Also, I just don't let it bother me as much and take as much time. We're all busy. Why obsess? The speech you just heard, of course, is Ronald Reagan's A Time for Choosing, which people used to name speeches back then. I don't know if people do that anymore, or if they do, people don't really care. But in A Time for Choosing, Ronald Reagan was the vice presidential candidate under Barry Goldwater. So this is way pre-presidency for Reagan, and it's during the Cold War. Hopefully many of you get the context there. I will say that when I was thinking about this episode and the topic, it is, in a sense, a time for choosing for all of us. I think a lot of what Ronald Reagan says in that speech, which I'll link in the show notes, of course, as we always do to things like this, a lot of what he says, even though it's in the context of two superpowers waging a Cold War and the calculus America will take in light of a clear threat from the Soviet Union, regardless of where you or your parents or grandparents stood on that issue at that time, a lot of what he says there can be applied to our personal lives. In a sense, it's always a time for choosing, because failure to make a decision is a decision itself, whether that be at the helm of a superpower or the steering wheel of your own life. And then Alexander Hamilton, quote, in a sense, tells us that if we want to achieve our goal, and if our goal is freedom and in our own lives, I think that is what it is, right? Whether you already have a business and are tired of being the slave to investors and board members and your employees, perhaps if you've been at it a long time and have had a lot of stress on your life, or if you are at the bottom rungs in a big corporation, all of us are trying to seek that full fulfillment of ourselves, that self-actualization. And for the most part, I would argue that largely comes through freedom, that choosing what we want to do. If you don't take any risk in achieving that, then you will be the slave to your masters. Only sometimes that master might be a broken version of yourself. Footnote number two, there's a lot of talk of Darwin in Charlie Munger's essay that I referred to in the body of this episode. Apparently, Darwin was just a fascinating man. He never claimed to be actually that intelligent. He was just more a master of his own faculties. He could withstand psychological biases, perhaps more than most. The evidence of evolution was staring many, many scientists in the face before Darwin and during Darwin's time, and even after he made the argument, along with a few other compatriots, I think, most people wouldn't listen for a long time, and it took a long time for them to come around to his and the right way of thinking. One thing he used to do, I think, to try and maintain sobriety psychologically is to wear hair shirts, some sort of hair. I don't know what that's, mohair, which I have no idea what mohair actually is, but something uncomfortable, whether it's that or something else, seems like we've lost that tradition of people like Seneca and the ascetics to try and maintain some level of awareness above and beyond others. I wonder what ideas all of you have for doing that. Feel free to hit me up on social media if you come up with anything. Finally, number three, the title of this episode is Hunger Strike, which we didn't talk a lot about withholding food from ourselves, despite the last footnote, but we did talk about that hunger that is inside all of us, at least in this audience, to achieve more in our lives. There is a song of the same name, though. It's not a coincidence. That song is from the 90s by a band called Temple of the Dog. It was a super group of Chris Cornell and Eddie Vedder and a bunch of the Pearl Jam Soundgarden members. It's a pretty awesome song, actually. And it gets the best probably out of both bands in this supergroup. There's a couple people missing, so it's not the full summation of both bands. Anyway, the music video, no surprise, takes place in Seattle, where both bands were founded. And I think Eddie Vedder still lives to this day. The video takes place at Discovery Park in Seattle. If you're ever there, it is a great place to go. Some parts are pretty cool, though. A commenter on YouTube says, you know, what if you were on the beach and just ran into Eddie Vedder and Chris Cornell jamming? There's a part at 1 minute and 30 seconds in that's kind of hilarious. Eddie Vedder looks possessed as he's staring in this tall grass. The best part of the song, though, is around 2 minutes and 40 seconds. Not that anyone's counting. Check it out. I will play a little bit here from a cover by Steve Hall. His brother, Les Hall, I think it is, produced and mixed the YouTube song / video. It is very good. I can't imagine someone doing a better cover. And it's also amazing that one guy, Steve Hall, does all the instruments, all the vocals, and manages to capture the vocal duet of Chris Cornell and Eddie Vedder extremely well, with sort of the intonations and verbal or vocal tics that each of them have a little bit. And those are not actually easy singers to emulate by any means. But he does it justice. It's not just imitation. It is art in its own right, I would argue. The only aside I'll have on this is that Steve Hall looks like he rented a Guitar Center for the video. Anyone who's been to Guitar Center will immediately know what I'm talking about. As always, please visit these videos, these resources, all of which are linked in the show notes, and show them some love, because they have given me some inspiration and enabled me to pass on their content to you. Good luck with your own hunger strike. We'll see you next time on The Warrior Poet.
Warrior Poet is a property of Rainiac Productions. If you like The Warrior Poet, there's more great content on Instagram. Follow Shri, The Warrior Poet, on Instagram. That's S-R-I, The Warrior Poet. You can also get to know me on a personal level by following Shri, actually, on Instagram as well. The Warrior Poet is produced by Laddie, with special contributions by Spoonman and me, Shri.
No, Kevin. Me no do it. Spita.